Hey, it's Brandi Cruz. You're listening to an Election 2024 interview with Joe Kent, a Republican candidate for Congress in Washington's 3rd Congressional District. Joe Kent, welcome to Undivided.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Yeah, well, we were at an event together, gosh, maybe a month ago.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I had never had him on my show. And you said, I thought you did. It must have been some other blonde chick. but I said, you know, I feel you're one of the instances where I feel like my TDS sort of got the best of me, because, you know, the more I see of you, the I think the worse I feel about some hostility. I mean, it wasn't even public hostility. It was just sort of internal, where I was like, oh, God, this guy. And so, you know, I feel differently having, you know, seen you more on the campaign trail now. So my apologies for letting my TDS bleed over to you. But I do want to go back in time a little bit. So, you know, your first campaign for the 3rd Congressional District, why'd you run it?
So really, I mean, the state of the country in 2020, backing up a little bit more, my late wife was killed fighting ISIS in Syria in 2019, a month after Trump tried to get our troops out the first time. So I started speaking out heavily on behalf of President Trump's foreign policy, because he was getting criticized heavily by the so-called adults in the room, the experts. So was really focused heavily on that, worked a little bit on the Trump 2020 campaign. And then between the riots and COVID, I felt like we were losing our country. And then the election went the way it did. And then, unfortunately, my congresswoman at the time, who I had voted for Trump's impeachment. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of people in our district who were frustrated by that and were saying, hey, we're going to write her a strongly worded letter. And, you know, I believe that when your congressperson doesn't represent you anymore, the mechanism is to primary them, is to run against them. And so I just didn't see anybody else stepping up. So I said, well, if nobody else is going to do it, I'm at least going to give it a shot.
Yeah. And I don't have a problem with that per se. I mean, I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I don't like either of the parties very much. And I think that sometimes this feeling like, oh, you can't challenge someone of your own party leads to people being in office for way too long, or people who shouldn't be in office. So I really don't have an issue with that. But given the fact that you lost that race, and you didn't just lose it, the district went to a Democrat and had been red, do you feel a sense of like culpability for losing that congressional district for Republicans?
Well, I mean, we had a hard-fought primary, lost by less than a percentage point in the general, but we had like a four-way split in the Republican primary. So yeah. I think it's a great lesson that shows if Republicans aren't united at the end of a primary, that the Democrats will exploit that. The Democrats are better organized than the Republicans. We're working on fixing that, but the Democrats just simply have a better political machinery behind them.
True.
So if we are divided by mid-August, it's not going to go well for us. And so I think the party learned a lesson there. I know I learned a lot of lessons running a campaign for a first time. I had never intended on getting into politics, but it was so close, less than a percentage point, that we say, hey, we'll give it a shot. We'll finish the job. We'll get it done this time.
Yeah. We'll talk about the party unity, because you've taken that lesson and applied it to some other races that are happening outside your race, which I want to discuss as well. But going back to the question, I mean, you didn't like that Jamie Hoyer Butler voted to impeach Trump, but wouldn't you have rather had her keep that seat than have it go to a Democrat?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So is there any regret about running and unseating a sitting Republican?
No, I think it needed to happen. I supported Jamie. I support her now in what she's trying to do with the Commissioner of Public Lands. But I think it was time to get her out of that position, in particular for casting that vote. And then also a few others, ones that she made here and there. But I think I view all that as being in the past. But I do think when you have incumbent Republicans who they start hitting the 8 to 10 years, the 12-year mark, and they're not coming back and they're not hearing from the people in the district, I think that's a real issue. And so I do think it is good to hold them accountable for that. And we can't put them anyone up on a pedestal and say, hey, we won't primary you just because we like the letter by your name.
Yeah. Do you feel the same way about Dan Newhouse right now then? Do you want him to lose his seat as well?
The people of that district are going to make up their minds right now.
Have you endorsed in that district?
No, I have not.
You haven't? Okay.
No, I think it's impressive that we have two Republicans running out there.
I mean, it is the only like red bastion left,
Pretty dark red, yeah.
Yeah, for now. I don't know.
Yeah.
More and more the way the state's going.
Our district shares a border, and for a while there, Clickitat County was in the 3rd. So I know a lot of people out there. And what is impressive to me, I like Sessler. He's a good guy. Dan Newhouse, I've had a lot of interactions with as well. Newhouse will show up and he will have really, really hard conversations with people consistently. You know, so I think that's impressive as a representative, even though I don't agree with, you know, the vote that he took, whatever. So I honestly just, I've stayed out of that. I'm focused on my race only, but it's going to be a good victory for Republicans either way.
Yeah. So there's a lot happening in the 3rd congressional district race that I want to touch on, but I guess, you mentioned one of the lessons learned is Republicans really need to coalesce, yeah. which your Republican primary opponent did pretty immediately come out and endorse you, yeah. which I give her a lot of credit for.
Absolutely.
She sat here pre-primary.
Yeah.
But for you as a candidate, because there's always something for me where I watch, like as a political reporter then and commentator now, where I'm like, when the same person runs for the same seat that they just lost like 2 years earlier, I'm like, why? What's different? So for you personally as a candidate, what do you feel like is different just 2 years later that gives you a better chance against the same person?
Sure. So three main factors.
Okay.
Number one is that we did not have a hard fought Republican primary. There was no incumbent Republican. There wasn't four of us on the ticket doing a 18, 19 months of a Republican primary. That caused some deep divisions. That's just the nature of hard primaries. Leslie Llewellyn was an absolute, class act the whole way, even when we were going against each other. Like, yeah. And our race never got nasty. Both of us really stayed focused on the Democrat and what she's doing to the district, how she's not representing the district. So we didn't have a hard fought primary. As you pointed out, Leslie immediately endorsed me. So Republican unity, I would say, is number one. Number two is really having a presidential year. Our district swings about 4 to 5 points more Republican across the board in presidentials. And that's something we've got to work on in the district because our voters are there. We just got to get them to turn out in municipal and in midterm elections. But the environment in that regard is more favorable. And then look, the third most, I think this is the most significant factor. When I ran against Marie Perez 2 years ago, she could say whatever she wanted to say. She didn't have a voting record. So she essentially could say, hey, look, I'm just this bipartisan moderate, but now she's got 2 years of voting in lockstep with the Democrats on everything from inflation to the open border to voting to put men into your daughter's dressing room. So highlighting her record has been, and holding her accountable for that and then really laying out what my vision for the future is. That's been really the focus of the campaign.
You're a more polished candidate, too.
I mean, for sure.
The outside looking in,
definitely.
Far more polished, far more disciplined.
Yeah.
You also, I know that your campaign can't coordinate with PACs, but Elon Musk gave a PAC for you, how much was it, Nicole? $300,000 or something? Yeah, like $370,000.
Pleasant surprise.
What is that about?
Pleasant surprise.
You didn't get totally blindsided by that?
I was, yeah. Yeah. So we can't coordinate with them.
Yeah.
But we saw, I track all the individual expenditures and usually I see them coming after me from the left. And so it was nice to see the America PAC, backed by Elon coming in.
Yeah.
And so Elon is obviously he's doing a lot with President Trump, but he's also got his eye on the House. And this is one of the top seats to flip to get firmer control of the House. So it was a very nice surprise. And I'm very grateful for the support.
Well, you've also had a lot of national Republicans. The Speaker of the House has been in, and I think in fact he's in again this week.
He is.
That for yeah. your race? Yeah.
Yeah.
So that has to tell you that they must be, the NRCC must yeah. be heavily invested.
They are. Yeah. Speaker Johnson and the NRCC have been great. We didn't get a lot of support from them in 2022.
Understandably.
This
so.
Year, it's like night and day. So this year, right after the primary, they came in immediately. They've been very supportive. They've helped us out with some hybrid ads. So yeah, again, back to the Republican unity.
Yeah.
I just feel that the Republican Party, not just in Washington State or Washington's 3rd district, but nationally, I just feel like there's like a lot more unity.
Yeah, there's also this this Trump thing that's, I'm curious to get your pulse on it. People always say, welcome to the Trump train, Brandy. I'm not on the Trump train.
I
have a ticket and it, is going to expire at a certain point of time. But I just cast my ballot for him for the first time after being full blown TDS for 8 years. So I have to believe there's more people like me out there
who
see the options and are like, okay, don't love them. Don't love either of them. But Trump's the only feasible option.
Mm-hmm.
So your support for Donald Trump from 2020 to 2022 in this state probably wasn't great. He had terrible approval ratings here. He had terrible performance here. Do you feel like it's less of an ick for voters that your support of Donald Trump?
It's not controversial anymore. I mean, Trump won.
Still controversial.
He won the 3rd district by 4 points in 16 and in 20. But in 2022, in that midterm that started really in 2021, there were a lot of people who were just like, I don't know. I voted for him, but I don't want to do it again.
Right.
And so there was a lot of that. However, I would say probably around this summer, last spring timeframe, things really changed. And, and you saw a lot more people just say, okay, we're now on board of Trump. And then I think the more time that goes on, and it's really become a binary choice. Like, I mean, I've followed a little bit of your journey as well. I think you speak for a lot of the country where you're just like, hey, there's a lot that I don't like, but this other side has lost its mind. And so I'm going to do what I can to save the country.
Yeah. Let's talk about your district a little bit. So I see it sort of, this is a real turning point for the third. I can see it going the direction of the eighth, where Republicans like, it flips and all of a sudden they're like, oh, well, now it's a Democrat district. And they almost like throw their hands up. I mean, they've done very little to help Carmen Goers in that race, frankly, not as much as they should. So your district is like baffles me because part of me, if I just look at it on paper, I would think, well, it has to be getting more and more blue because you're right by Portland.
Right by Portland,
And I have to think more and more people are moving out, you know, trying to get, you know, more affordable housing or just out of the garbage of Portland. And then there's two, so within your congressional district, there's two legislative districts that are like must win, going to be hard fought races for Republicans, the 17th and the 18th. Yeah. So you've got this district that is like purple, like congressional district. You've got these internal legislative districts that are like battleground districts. So what is the makeup of that congressional district becoming that makes it so competitive?
I think it's still a very common sense district. I think our more rural communities, if we can drive the turnout up there, I think Republicans can win in all these different seats. But you're right. There's the Vancouver metropolitan area that is getting some bleed over from Portland. There's some people there who I think historically haven't identified as Republicans, and they may have some of the ick about Trump and probably about me a little bit. However, I think, just to be honest, if you just look at the way that Democrats have ran our cities, whether it's Portland just to our south or Seattle, I think there are a lot of people who are saying, okay, you know, I see that this is not going well. They look at the inflation. They look at the open border. We've had a fentanyl epidemic in our district as well. So I think people are coming over, you know, more to our side. But we do have a lot of rural roots. I mean, there's a lot of folks who historically have made a living in the timber industry, on the river, in the fishing industries. I mean, out in Pacific County, we've got folks that make their living, you know, cranberry farmers, oystermen. I mean, these are very, very much blue-collar workers that have been really hurt by this economy, hurt by overregulation, and they just see that the Democrat Party has completely and totally left them. So I think we've got a real opportunity. I agree with you that this is a pivotal year. I think we've got a real opportunity to kind of bring everybody into the fold and say, hey, maybe we don't agree on like absolutely everything, but we can't go down the direction that the Democrats want to take us.
Yeah, I think if you can't flip it back this year, I think it goes the way of the eighth. I think that it's going to be really hard to regain that sort of momentum. But you bring up, you know, some of the blue collar workers in the third, and that's what I think of when I think of the third. But it's also what I think of when I think of the sixth. Like the whole peninsula, all these industries that have utterly collapsed, leaving people in poverty, and they might send Emily Randall, like one of the most extreme Democrats in the state, to Congress for them. So as you go out and talk to working class voters who might be undecided, have you gotten a sense for what might appeal to a Democrat for them?
I think there's some historic loyalties to like the union mentality.
Sure. Okay.
With the union leadership. But when you talk to like rank and file union guys, I mean, unless we're talking about the teachers unions, but in general, if it's blue collar, if it's police, fire, law enforcement, I mean, these guys, they're rank and file are with us on the vast majority of issues, but especially with like your trades, these people realize, and this is what, you know, Trump really capitalized heavily on in 2016 was that, hey, both parties have kind of been screwing you guys over. I mean, we're shipping jobs overseas, we're importing foreign labor, we're overregulating business, and who does that hurt? That hurts, you know, blue collar, everyday Americans. And so I think the way that we're building a more, I would call it like a more populist coalition, saying, hey, our job is to put our workers and our people first. And that comes down to everything from border security to not getting involved in new foolish wars and sending billions of dollars overseas every year, but also making sure that there is a pro-business and pro-labor work environment here in the country.
Yeah, populist. I love it that Democrats have painted that as a dirty word. Yeah, I think populist is like the best thing that could
Amen.
Happen.
Amen.
To, you know, as long as it's not like turned into this like sort of, you know, right wing, like anti-immigrant sentiment or whatever it is, you know, populism is like, isn't that what we should be doing? I don't get it. You bring up the union thing. Oh, it's so interesting. Did you see the Boeing workers booing Maria Cantwell?
I did see that. I was pretty surprised.
Holy smokes.
But I mean, but these are people who are waking up. Yeah, they're seeing that what she has been voting for, regardless of what she says. I mean, I'm sure she had a nice speech that was written for her that she was going to deliver, how she's standing with the workers. But when you look at these people's voting record, like, it is working directly against American workers of every stripe. So, yeah, it's refreshing to see.
It's interesting. So let's talk about a few issues. There are some things that you have fundamentally changed from 2022. You know, 2022 was the abortion election.
Yeah, it was.
Where Roe was overturned, and then we saw what was supposed to be this red tsunami absolutely just dissipate.
Yeah.
And you have since changed your position. You, and correct me if I'm mischaracterizing, you were in favor of a national abortion ban in 2022 when you ran, and now you like it with the states. What changed for you?
Well, I think that the Supreme Court made it really easy. I mean, the Supreme Court took it out of the purview of the federal government.
But that happened before your 2022 general election.
Yeah, it happened like right as. But also getting out and talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, even in a district that swung Republican, abortion is still a very controversial issue.
Yeah.
I'm pro-life. You know, fundamentally, I understand the case for exceptions and all that type of stuff. So I think the federal government taking it out of their purview and putting it back with the states is the right thing. I think anytime you have a really divisive issue like that, the further we move it away from Washington, D.C. and closer to the people, I think that's a good solution. But really, I mean, you know, a big part of being a candidate is getting out and talking to people. Yeah. And I think an important part of being a representative is getting out and talking to people and saying like, okay, well, there's the fundamental way I feel, but there's how everybody else here feels. And abortion, it's like, it's a hot button issue. And so I think saying, hey, the federal government's going to stay out of this. It's going to stay at the state level. And in Washington state, abortion just simply isn't on the ballot.
I mean, is that just a convenience to make you more electable, or is that, how do you convince people that's what you really believe and will do?
Well, I mean, that's what I believe. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still am fundamentally pro-life, because of my faith, but also like, look, if you want to be a representative and you want to represent the people, you do need to go listen to them and figure out where you're out of touch with the way they feel. So I think as Republicans, especially on this issue, we do need to get back out and build back some more faith and some more trust and just talk with people. And I think really just taking a look at the way our system works, and took another support and defend the Constitution when I was in the military, regardless of who the commander in chief was, I followed those orders, and the Supreme Court has spoken and said, hey, this is back down at the state level. So it is most certainly not on our, you know, congressmen and our senators to say, we're going to try and overturn this or whatever. So again, back at the state level, I think is the way where it belongs.
So if they dangle that, Congressman Kent, you know, you're pro-life, and they're like, let's just make some reasonable restrictions nationally in the House.
Yeah.
You're saying you will not support
any
variation of a ban on abortion.
I won't. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I think that's the right thing. And I think more pro-choice representatives, I think it's the same thing with them. Like, hey, this is out of the federal government's purview. Let's put it right back down at the states. Washington and Idaho, they're different states. They're going to have different policies.
It makes so much sense to me. I'm pro-choice, and I love that. It's like, why wouldn't you? People call it a patchwork. Patchwork's great. Everybody can, if it really is your issue, like, you can move somewhere else. You know, if it really is like abortion is the number one thing for you, then you have another state you can go to where it fits your worldview. Mm-hmm. So with the states is great. On immigration, which is, this has been an interesting issue to watch kind of Marie Perez sort of try to find her. She's almost, and I don't think she's, I don't think she's an extreme Democrat. We might disagree on that. I don't think that she's one of the more extreme Democrats that we have in this state at all. But she's sort of playing the Kamala Harris game a little bit with like immigration, where it's like, you know, oh, now I'm like, you know, totally border security. So describe the difference between the two of you on the issue of the border.
The big thing is her record. I mean, she had an opportunity to vote for HR2, which is probably the best border and immigration reform bill that we've had in decades. Mm-hmm. And so she voted against that. She voted to leave the Biden-Harris border wide open. And it wasn't for another year that you heard the Democrats even talk about the border. As a matter of fact, she came back to the district and said, no one stays awake at night worrying about the southern border. Mm-hmm. And she's tried to walk back those comments, whatever. But at the end of the day, like, her voting record doesn't lie. So the big issue we have right now is that the border is very much open. I've been down there twice to take a look myself. And so we have an issue of unvetted people coming directly into our country, and we have the fentanyl that's getting pumped into our nation. And all the proposals that the Democrats have laid out, they don't address those two fundamental issues. So they're all fundamentally against actually building a wall, a physical barrier that stops the fentanyl from being smuggled across the border. And then also the asylum loophole needs to be closed. Under even Obama, but especially under Trump, you couldn't come right to America and claim asylum. Like, we're very generous that we let people claim asylum. But the common sense solution before that was that you had to either remain in Mexico or you had to go to the first safe third country. We had to vet you, then we let you into the country. If you go down to the border, even if you see the footage, you'll see most of the people that are streaming across the border, they're running to Border Patrol officers, not away from them, because they know if they can claim asylum, they will be given a legal status inside America.
Yeah, and they might not have a court hearing for...
Yeah, if they show 30 up for
years.
It. Yeah, exactly, so right.
Like, that works out pretty well.
Right.
You are in favor of President Trump's plan for mass deportation, correct?
Yeah.
I have some concerns with it, only because I don't see how it's even feasible. I mean, do you see, look at how little law enforcement we have to be able to assist the feds with some sort of undertaking like that? So first and foremost, do you think that something like that, what do we have, 18 million?
The numbers vary
illegal immigrants in the country. How do you even, is that even feasible?
So I think it is, because if we cut off the financial incentives for a lot of them to be here, I think we can encourage a lot of self-deportation. And so I think a bill that we need to pass right away in Congress says that there is no pathway to become an American citizen. You will never be an American citizen if you come into our country illegally. And I think what we can do is we can pass that. And if we can get it through the Senate, hopefully we flip the Senate and hopefully we have Trump in the White House. We pass that and we say, hey, this bill goes into effect in 60 days, whatever the number is. If you're gone between now and then, we can have a conversation later on and you can apply to come in the right way. But if we catch you past this day, like, no questions asked, you're done, you'll never be an American citizen. And stop giving out blanket amnesties. Because right now, if you come into our country illegally, we've been giving out blanket amnesties longer than all of us have been alive since the 60s, right? So if you come into our country illegally now, it's a safe assumption that someday you'll just be given amnesty and it's not a big deal. And then I think we cut off all the financial incentives. I mean, Perez and all the Democrats have loaded up a nice amount of benefits these illegals can get. Cut off that financial incentive. And then look, we've got to start going after American companies that are hiring illegals. Because the illegal immigration right now, it's basically a free corporate tax subsidy that a lot of these major corporations are getting. So we use mandatory E-Verify. We make it so that if you want to be able to write off the tax income of an employee, you need to be able to verify they're here illegally on a visa. And then start taxing, you know, the remittance of the illegals, or even potentially shut down a lot of those mechanisms for sending money back home. I think if we cut off a lot of those incentives, you're going to see a massive amount of these people, because most of the folks that came over, like, they were offered a good deal. Like, why wouldn't they come over? When the good deal leaves, I think a lot of them will leave too. Then that's going to let us really focus our finite law enforcement resources on the people who remain. Because the people who remain, when all that's cut off, those are the guys we need to look into.
That's a much more nuanced way of, I wish every Republican who supported that plan would describe it that way, because when you talk about mass deportation, it sounds like you're going door to door, like ripping parents away from their kids and stuff like that. But if some are self-deporting themselves, essentially, so you're talking about then what's left is like the people who are like, committing crimes, you know, up to no good, have no interest in lawful American citizenship.
Those are the guys we need to take a hard look at. I mean, because under Biden, it's estimated 10 to 12 million illegals have come in. Last time I went down to the border in February, the vast majority I saw crossing, I think I can count on one hand the number of like Hispanics I saw.
Oh, yeah.
It was Chinese nationals. It was guys from the Middle East. These were not guys these were not guys that looked like they were looking to go work on a construction site. I mean, these guys look like, I mean, I spent 20 plus years in special forces. Most of them look like me and my friends when we would go into countries in civilian clothes. Not saying that's what all of them are here for. However, like we have to have a sifting mechanism. And I think cutting off the financial incentives, getting those people out of here. And then I think our law enforcement does need to get very, very serious about going after threats from within.
Yeah. I think another area of disagreement for you and the Congresswoman is certainly American intervention overseas in conflicts. Yeah. So let's take them separately, because you know, they are separate. So Ukraine, what's happening in Israel. On Ukraine, to what extent would you support American aid for their ongoing war?
For the ongoing war, I think we've really exhausted what we should be giving, because for the last 2.5 years, I mean, February will be 3 years, we have had this strategy which says that we will send an unlimited amount of money and we will send an unlimited amount of arms to Ukraine. I was against that from the onset. However, we've been trying that now for the last 2.5 plus years. It is, by any metric, it has absolutely failed. Russia controls more ground inside Ukraine than they did at the beginning of the war. A generation of young Ukrainians is dead. It's hard to get the exact numbers, but they're drafting guys that are, you know, in their mid-40s right now to put on the front line. Ukraine's simply running out of bodies. So this strategy has absolutely failed. I think we need to invest in getting the killing to stop, getting both sides to the negotiating table, something that should really concern everyone. every single American, is that we've already crossed President Biden's stated red lines. At the beginning of the war, Biden said we would not give long-range American missiles to the Ukrainians because they're going to shoot them into Russia, and that potentially could be World War III. Well, about 2 months ago, that started happening, and it's continuing to this day. You've got joint Russian and Chinese air patrols that are, you know, taking place off the Alaskan coast. So right now, nuclear tensions are higher than they've been since the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I think us saying to the Ukrainians, hey, look, we and NATO can potentially help you guys with some sort of reconstruction because Ukraine will need that. But we're only going to do that if you guys are at the negotiating table with the Russians, with getting the Russians to the negotiating table, simply saying that we're not going to put Ukraine into NATO. I think that would get them to the negotiating table. The Ukrainians and the Russians were at the negotiating table at the beginning of the war. It was the West that moved them away.
Let me ask you this and be honest with me. Former President Trump has been on the campaign trail saying after he's elected, when he's the president-elect, that he will have that issue resolved before he even takes office. Do you think that's feasible?
Before he takes office, I think he'll have it done in very short order. I think there's a good chance, though, because, look, both, at least Zelensky knows that the money is mostly going to stop for the continuation of the war. So I think once Trump, it's clear that he is going to be the president, I think Zelensky's tune is going to change a good deal just for self-preservation. I think he's going to go to Trump and say, okay, let's help me cut a deal.
Yeah.
You know, because that just makes sense. And look, at the end of the day, like, Putin is a bad guy. Got it. However, he hasn't escalated any further, even though he's got American missiles flying into territorial Russia.
Any further, though. Can you escalate it any further? I mean, you talking about nukes?
Well, I mean, what would we do if we had Chinese and Russian made missiles being shot into America by Mexican or Canadian proxies?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we'd be escalating a lot.
Yeah, but I mean, he's the original escalator.
Sure.
You know, so.
I mean, yeah. But I do believe that he wants this thing to end, too. And the good thing, and Trump is a very good negotiator. He's a good deal maker. Yeah. I think we're at a point right now where both sides, both the Ukrainians and the Russians, Zelensky and Putin, they could stop the killing. They could freeze the conflict right now where it is. And they could both turn to their people and they could reasonably say, and they could sell this because it's partially true. It's really true of the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians can, Zelensky can turn to his people and say, we did it.
Yeah.
We defended our country. Mm-hmm. You know, we defended our country from Russia and we really proved a point here. We didn't cave. Putin can turn to his people and he can say, look, we kept NATO off of our border. And I think that's a great solution right there where both sides can say, hey, they won. There's going to be, you know, where those lines are in the sand. I don't want us drawing up that. Like, I don't want America deciding where other countries' borders are.
Yeah.
But getting both sides to stop the killing and take down the tensions is, I think, essential.
So how do you feel about American assistance to Israel? I mean, they've been much stingier when it comes to helping Israel in their war against Hamas. But you're talking about terrorists. I mean, you know, you know the price of very well the price of fighting evil.
Yeah. I think it is very safe to say that October 7th never would have happened had Trump still been in office. Biden came in, he re-entered this foolish Iran deal. Overnight, we juiced Iran with probably around $200 billion. And that money's continuing to flow to this day. The Iranians were smart. They knew they needed to get rid of the Abraham Accords, the historic peace between the Sunni Gulf states and Israel. And so they planned, conducted, and really made October 7th happen. Same thing with the Houthis in the Red Sea. And really, the Biden administration and Democrats writ large, they've attempted to fund both sides of this war and speak out of both sides of their mouth. Now, Perez will say, oh, I support Israel as well. However, right after the October 7th attacks, House Republicans had immediate aid to Israel on the floor within about a week. They took the $14 billion from Biden's weaponized IRS, and they said, we're going to reallocate that to immediate aid to Israel. The Democrats wanted to use the crisis in Israel as a negotiating chip to get more aid for Ukraine because the Ukraine aid had stalled. And so, unfortunately, America spent the next, I think, 4 or 5 months not giving Israel the immediate assistance they needed while they were in a huge fight against terrorists who had just killed 1,500 of their own people because the Democrats wanted to negotiate this greater aid package. So look, I think that number one, you cut off all the funding going to Iran. Going after the government of Iraq is absolutely essential in that regard as well. That actually saves the American people money. Yeah. And so I think that's probably one of the bigger lifts that we could do for Israel. But look, Israel needs to finish the job. I think the only mistake Israel's made in this conflict is listening to America. I mean, they just killed Sinwar, the head of Hamas, in Rafah. They should have been in Rafah by the end of October of 2023. They weren't because Biden and Harris blocked them from doing that. So we need to stop adjudicating like block by block urban combat and give them the support they need, but really cut off the funding going to Iran. I think that's the most essential thing that we can do.
Yeah. I do want to ask you about some races unrelated to yours, sort of. Mm-hmm. I think there's a nexus. But for people who remain undecided in the third, I mean, they've got their ballots in their hand right now. If they're truly undecided, what is it for you that you think will convince them to vote for Joe Kent?
I would say just really take a look at me and my opponent have done 4 different debates now. 3 of them are on network TV.
Spicy.
They got spicy. They're not boring to watch. I saw that.
A screenshot of her like so angry. I said, no.
They're definitely not dry debates. Yeah. So they get spicy. I say take a look at the debates. And then if you go to mariewatch.com, you can take a look at what her voting record is. Mm-hmm. I try and do as much media as possible. That's why I'm happy to be here and drive up and see you. I do a lot of events too. We're doing town halls pretty much every day. So I'd encourage people just to come out to a town hall, reach out to the campaign. If they're still undecided and there's a specific issue they'd like for me to talk with me about, I'm more than happy to have that conversation. But really, I would just look at just the trajectory of our country right now. Perez has voted in lockstep with her party on every single essential matter. She's being funded to the tune of millions of dollars by her party. They're not funding her to go be an independent. They're funding her to be in lockstep with their party. The Democrats are taking our country in a horrible direction. So I would just say right now at this point, the choice is pretty binary, just like the presidential with Trump versus Harris. Like, who do you think can actually lead us into a better future and get us out of all these various crises?
Yeah, and we have invited the Congresswoman on if she would like to also make the drive up and chat with us. We would love to have a conversation with her. So in Washington State, the Republican electorate concerns me a little bit. I feel like it's been a little bit fractured, the party, the voting base. So there's a couple separate issues I think that you can be very helpful on.
Yeah.
So first of all, you said you're supporting Jamie Hoyer Butler for Lance Commissioner.
100%.
And your message to Republican voters in this state who might not want to because of her vote to impeach former President Donald Trump is what?
I ran against Jamie and I I picked Jamie's voting record apart, and I went after her on a lot of things. A place I could never touch Jamie on because she was absolutely fantastic is public lands. Jamie knows our forests. She knows our rivers, and she understands how to like both preserve them, but also to revitalize those industries. And so Jamie's record on what matters, the job that she's running for, it's stellar. It just is, period, end of story. Like, I could never hit her on those issues when I was running against her. And also, look, at this point, it's binary. Like, she is running against a Democrat. And again, the Democrats are not funding her opponent so that he can go in there and, like, have some, you know, compromise with people that want to continue to, you know, use our timber industry and our rivers. Like, the Democrats are completely on board with, like, this Green New Deal nonsense. And we've had some horrible policy decisions made on our beautiful and natural environment here in Washington State. And that's what her opponent stands for. So, I mean, I can't make a stronger endorsement for Jamie.
Yeah, not just any Democrat, like a Seattle progressive Democrat.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, so if the anger at Jamie for one vote is going to I just tell people, like, you got to pull your head out because that would just be 100%. An insane protest vote.
Yeah.
On the governor's race. So you're pretty close with Semi Byrd, or you at least supported his campaign for governor.
Even before I think David announced, Semi told me he was going to run.
Yep.
A lot of mutual friends in Special Forces. Semi had a good reputation. So was happy to support him. But then post-primary, look, it's binary. Again, and I've never had anything bad to say about Dave. Dave's a sheriff. He's a veteran. Like, he is a conservative. He's a great guy. So again, never had anything bad to say about Dave. But look, when the primaries are over, guys, our primaries are already laid enough as it is. We already have the goofy jungle primary system. Everything in Washington is stacked against whichever party is the least organized. Republicans are the least organized.
Always,
so don't, I mean, because we're independent thinkers, and I understand why we are culturally, and the Democrats, I understand culturally why they are better organized. But with our late primaries, like, we cannot be divided. Like, when that second week of August hits, I don't care if your guy didn't win. It's binary. I mean, Dave Reichert is running against Bob Ferguson.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think things are going great in this state right now and you want more of it, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. And Bob Ferguson, I personally believe that Bob Ferguson is worse than Jay Inslee because I think he's smarter and I think he understands lawfare. So look, we need to have Dave Reichert in there. And look, if you look at the people who voted against Bob Ferguson in that primary, we can still win this thing. People are always saying, oh, it's hopeless because of, you know, the Puget Sound area. We can never win. I mean, just look at all the folks that voted against Bob Ferguson. Mm-hmm. He is not a popular Democrat. There's even Democrats who I think are, they're probably not going to tell anybody, but they're probably going to vote for Dave Reichert.
Oh, I already know. I know some.
Yeah.
I know one Democrat who I'll never name who endorsed Bob Ferguson and told me privately that they are voting for Dave Reichert.
And I think that represents a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I really do. So, I mean, I know, and I talked to some Republicans who are not happy with the way some things went in the primary. And mm-hmm. like, look, you know what? In 15 or 16 days, if you want to go back to talking about that, that's your prerogative. Yep. Between now and then, like, we've got to save our state and we've got to prevent Bob Ferguson from getting elected.
Yeah, let's end with this because it is relevant to your race. You need every Republican voter to show up.
I do.
And they have felt, and there's some Republican voters who don't like our mail-in system. They don't think their vote counts. They think some Democrat takes it and shoves it somewhere under a couch cushion.
Yeah.
What would your message be to Republican voters who have been burned so many times, lost so many races, been let down so many times that they are just thinking, and there is a lot. I've been door knocking for Dave Reichert.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of people who said, I'm not voting.
Oh, yeah.
What's your message to them?
Don't do the Democrats' work for them. I mean, look, the Democrats want you to believe it's all rigged. They want you to believe everything you just said, that they have such an elaborate system that there's no way Republicans can win. So it's even pointless to even vote. You are just absolutely making the Democrats do no work at that point. So we can win these races if everybody turns out. If you're skeptical about what happens at the county auditor's office, then you need to volunteer to be an election observer. And I can tell you, and I think this is across the board, we have Republican observers in all of these different auditors' offices. I don't like the fact that we do all mail out, but we're not going to change that. We're not going to be able to change that until we win more races. And so we need to drive turnout. So take your ballot, vote as soon as you get it. We're encouraging everyone to vote early. If you're skeptical about it, then go drive it down to the county auditor's office and hand it to them. Mm-hmm. Most of the times they'll even make sure that your signature checks out right there. Or take it to one of the drop boxes. We haven't had any issues with drop boxes. The pickups for the drop boxes are all observed by both parties as well. But for God's sakes, even if you think, you know, 50-50 chance this might not work, do not let the Democrats win by not voting. They want you to not vote. Don't do all the heavy lifting for them. You must vote. And again, if you look at just the people who voted, again, against Bob Ferguson, if you look at the numbers that Leslie and I had, Perez didn't crack 50%. She had no primary opponent.
Yep.
If you look at the numbers that we have, Republicans can win in this state.
Yeah. And we don't want to wake up November 6th and have it be like a 20 vote difference. I mean, look at the public lands commissioner race.
Yeah.
Just this much from having two Republicans move forward. So, Joe Kent, good luck to you.
Thank you
for coming all the way up to chat. Yeah. And we'll be watching this race with interest.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this Election 2024 interview. To listen to other interviews we've done with candidates this cycle, check out our website at undividedpod.com.